from the CEO, kind of requested.
Yeah, you may be able to fly without the service manual when you just open up the case and find where the power supplies and regulators are. In the past, all of those regulators are extremely well labeled with light emitting diodes on these edge connector printed circuit boards telling you if that voltage is present. And one of the pins on the edge of the board, a pin you can easily clip on your probe, your scope probe to, will tell you exactly what voltage is supposed to be there. Your scope will then look at that voltage in the DC mode, say, yeah, the voltage is there. Go to the AC mode, measure the amount of ripple. So without the service manual, without a schematic, more than 50% of all the service you can do just by using common sense. To me, to CDL, KQRIW.
Yeah, I just want to ask you, what model number analyzer are we talking about?
8594. Go ahead.
Okay, I have an 8590, and that's what Eric just mentioned on his website. He said 08590. So it might not be the same schematic. Obviously, it won't be the same schematic because the 8590 only goes up to 1.5 gigs. I think the 94 goes up to 26 gigs or so. Is that right?
Something like that, but I'll bet you the general philosophy of the way it works is very similar. The one that goes to higher frequency is really just using a greater range to the gig filter on the front end and a higher harmonic mixing function. But the rest of the analyzer is going to be extremely similar, in my opinion. From what you're seeing with that manual, Eric, I'll bet you each of that series has strong similarity. Is that true, Eric?
Yeah, the manuals are for this series. It's called the 8590 series. And actually, the series, there's obsolete devices, but the current 8590Q is actually a QAM measuring device. These series were made for cable systems and, you know, people who needed portable stuff to go out in the field with. So they're not extremely highly accurate. And the noise for this thing is, look at the calibration measurements. It only goes down to minus 80. They don't consider lower than that to be, like, critical.
Which one of those analyzers of that series do you own, Eric? Go ahead.
Actually, the analyzers that I use, unfortunately, they're not HPs. I have a couple of Tektronics. But I also have the Advent, what I use to go up into the multiple microwave region, because I have stuff at 24 gigs and 30 gigs that I can keep my eyes on. I've got a U3661, which is a really cool box. It's, it's got an LCD display. I think it's around 60 grand, but it's a very nice analyzer. It's not too heavy.
You gave us a brand name and I missed it. Did you say Enritsu?
Say again, Dick?
You gave us a brand name for your spectrum analyzer. You said it's not an HP. Did you say the brand name was Enritsu?
No, actually I got a couple, but the one that I use mostly is an Advent. It's actually made in Japan, Advent. It's distributed by Tektronix, believe it or not. But I've also got a couple of Rhodes and Schwartz and a few other goodies. But what we kind of use for the UHF transmitter is it's the Tektronix, you know. Typical, I forget what model number it is, but how often I use it.
Give me a couple of words in Advent. I'm not familiar with that brand.
It's distributed by Tektronix. It's Japanese. This stuff has been around for a while. I mean, you know, you got to remember, Tektronix used to do telemeasurements, which was out of England years ago, and stuff that they don't feel like making is they usually get somebody else to manufacture their specifications. So it's a real good product.
Yeah, I bet you they don't appear very much on the flea market around here. Sounds like a nice machine. To my knowledge, among serious radio engineers, a spectrum analyzer is, in the past, the most used piece of test equipment day in and day out. Nowadays, a really good network analyzer is starting to take over, particularly when you're building things like antennas and amplifiers and mixers and whatever. Well, go a little slow on the word mixer. You go through a procedure by which a network analyzer will look at something that does a frequency conversion like a mixer, and life gets very complicated because of the way it does everything in a coherent manner between the signal generator and the detecting circuit. A lot of synchronous demodulation coherence is taking place in a good network analyzer. But network analyzers are starting to take over. But in the past, in the very recent past, spectrum analyzer is the most used piece of test equipment. Even in the case of a person who's doing two-way radio equipment work with his service monitor, the spectrum analyzer function of the service monitor is very frequently used. Let's see if Joe has any further questions or fill requirements. My greatest recommendation from where you stand right now, Joe, is to check all those power supply voltages, their accuracy, and their ripple. And once you pass that test, then the calibration procedure stands a chance. If you don't pass that test, the calibration procedure is going to drive you up a wall. W2RYY, T2RIW.
Hi, Jack. Well, here's Van Ace of Tuning Match Filter, doing the final tuning of the antenna, the transmission line, a whole bunch of things. We don't own one. We rent one when we need it. But also, a lot of the manufacturers use V&A to calibrate their solid-state amplifiers. Most of the transmitters have multiple boards in them and dozens of Wilkinson dividers and combiners, and that's what you use.
In the broadcast industry right now, Eric, would you say spectrum analyzer or vector network analyzer, VNA, which one would you say is used the most, or are they almost tied? Back to you, Eric.
Well, most of the individual broadcasters, of course, they're losing people. There aren't that many people that can fix this stuff anymore. That's the first thing, for a number of reasons. One is you need a microscope to see half of it. And the other is that the technology is so, especially with the digital stuff, it's beyond most engineers that have been in the business for so many years. But broadcast manufacturers, you'll see exclusively VNAs, not necessarily spectrum analyzers. Because today's VNAs are part spectrum analyzer and very well calibrated at that. But the VNA is a more useful tool. I wish I had one full time.
And by the way, the work that I do every day puts me an hour or two every day under a microscope. And it's only about 30 dB gain, not real high gain. Stereo zoom microscope with good illumination. You really need one of those, Eric. The next time I run into a flea market deal where one of those is as cheap as the one that I personally own, I'm going to buy it for you and hand it to you. How you have survived without it by just using jeweler's loops and great big magnifying glasses, sight lamps. How you have survived this is a bit amazing to me. Thank you, Eric.
If you find one that's nice and cheap, let me know, because I've been on eBay looking all over. But what I did finally do is, since China is this really wonderful place, I bought an SMD rework station that, you know, I could have spent like $4,000 or $5,000 on. There's a Chinese manufacturer that makes a fabulous setup, and I only spent $500 with a board preheater and all the nozzles that you could possibly imagine. It was just great.
Are you in motion at this time? Because the signal strength I'm getting out of you is jumping around in a very funny way.
KV2, JXM.
JXM recognized, but Eric first.
No, I'm not moving. I'm on a fixed antenna. It must be, the band's been kind of funny lately. I mean, it was open and then closed. I was keying up stuff last night I couldn't believe.
Who we owe, Dick?
Rich also recognized him. JXM first, go ahead. Start off with your name, sir.
Thanks. You got Gary over here, KV2JXM. I just have a quick question about a network analyzer measuring receive loss. I believe in port 1 you would inject the signal of, say, a certain amount of dBm and connect the antenna jack from the receiver to port 2 and also inject the same amount of dBm into the receiver and measure of receive loss that way. Is that correct?
Wow. First of all, Gary, I'm not sure. Are you testing an antenna, testing a receiver, testing a mixer? You didn't tell us what you're testing. And usually a network analyzer. We call them vector network analyzers, and there's a scalar version of it, scalar network analyzer. It has a signal generator. The way people normally use it is J1 is the port that is supplying the signal. You apply J1 with a calibrated cable to the device on the test. The output of the device on the test with a calibrated cable goes back to J2 of the network analyzer. That's the typical way they're hooked up. You mentioned receiver, you mentioned antenna, and you confused me. Over to you, Gary.
Sorry about that. No, I was trying to measure receive loss, receiver loss. As far as the antenna goes, I was saying hooking up the antenna connector of the receiver to port 2. But, okay.
Unless your particular network analyzer has a reverse mode, most of them, the signal generator is supplying the signal out of the J1 port of the network analyzer. That in turn through a calibrated cable goes to the device on the test. The output of the device, the input level of the device on the test, the output port of the device on the test with a calibrated cable goes back to J2. That's the usual way of doing it. And for most network analyzers, the signal you apply to the device on the test and the signal that comes out of the device on the test has to be the exact same signal frequency. In the case of a receiver, if you made the logical sounding guess of, hey, I want to find out what the receiver's doing, so I'll apply J1 to the RF front end, and I'll take the IF strip, and with a cable, I'll couple that back to the network analyzer J2 port. Because the frequencies are different by way of the mixer action, most network analyzers will go tilt on that particular situation. Now back to you, Gary.
I have is if the network analyzer does have a built-in signal generator coming out of we'll say built into the network analyzer, and your calibrated cable is coming out of port 1 going into the receiver. Now, how are you connecting the receiver if you already have a cable going to the, you know, in the back of the receiver?
Okay, I'm happy. I think you're getting out of range. I'm copying you both on the input and the output simultaneously of this machine. A network analyzer allows you to test something that normally has the exact same input and output frequency, and it's a two-port device, like, say, for instance, a filter or an RF amplifier. But it's got to have the exact same input and output frequency for the network analyzer to work. Rarely do you use a network analyzer to measure the response of a total receiver. There's a special piece of test equipment which will do a SINAD test, and maybe somebody would naively call that a network analyzer. I wouldn't. A SINAD test set. So you can test one stage or a couple of stages at a time of a receiver that have a common input and output frequency. But if any frequency conversion is taking place, you may not be able to, under normal circumstances, use a network analyzer. And as I said, almost all network analyzers have a signal generator built in, and the signal it supplies comes out of the J1 port of the network analyzer under normal conditions. Now back to you, Gary.
CV2HWW.
We recognize you're the third in the list. Gary, if you're still there.
I went to New Jersey right now, and I'll be home in about 5 minutes. I'd like to get into a little more detail with this pump, but assuming this at this time, I'll have to try again in a couple of weeks when when I have, next time I meet you on there. I've experienced a little bit with network analyzers, not all that much. I know you got to calibrate them to a short, calibrate them again to an open, but I'm going to have to draw a diagram to further one with this. So, it's a drop for an hour, we'll be better safe to there. Excellent, we'll be here to
son. Yeah, sounds like Gary's running out of range in New Jersey, and there's a lot of different ways you can misuse a network analyzer. They're capable of giving you a lot of information used correctly, calibrated correctly, but you can get some pretty crazy answers out of them. Okay, we had Glenn, Mel, and Howie, I think in that order. Glenn first, QIQ, I think it was. Go ahead, K2LIW.
Good evening, Dick.
Good evening, Dick. Glenn, K5. When he was mentioning what he was measuring, I think I have to agree that measurement doesn't sound like something that normally made. But I just wanted to add a comment also that you had mentioned that, you know, in terms of measuring insertion loss for the network analyzer, but most of the network analyzers that these are usually capable of also measuring return loss would be a bit more.
Without a doubt, it's possible, Glenn, but I sort of doubt it. Almost nobody cares about the return loss, standing wave ratio, or S11 of the input port of a receiver. It happens to be something real, but you can't do anything with that information. You take, for instance, the average receiver, you look at that input port, and I'll be amazed if you get much below a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio across the band of interest. And if you're testing something like a very high performance, low noise amplifier, for, let's say, moonbound for satellite work, you are intentionally misadjusting the input port in order to maximize the noise figure, which is kind of crazy. You adjust a high-performance, low-noise amplifier for best input standing wave ratio, and you'll be reasonably far away from the adjustment for best noise figure. Okay, the next person on the list, I think, was Mel, K2KEY. I think you're next on the list. Go ahead.
Okay, I was going to make some comments to him, but we lost him, so go on, Dick, because it's getting late.
Okay, the next person in the list was Howie, and then Rich in that order. Howie, go ahead.
I have no comment. I was going to make a comment that you use a service monitor, not a network analyzer, for doing a receiver. The only thing I can think of using a network analyzer is if you want to tune the front end of a receiver and you're able to, and the front end has connectors and you want to look at the tuning of the cavities or something. But other than that, I can't see any purpose. Go ahead.
I'm with you, Howie. See what Richard got to say. And 2EO, go right ahead.
You may want to take this later after the subject, but I just want to digress to something that you mentioned to Eric about the microscope 5 minutes or so ago when I broke in. And like I say, you may want to take this after the network analyzer discussion. But I'm wondering if anybody knows where to get a good set of eye goggles, magnifying goggles. I had a set here that was was an optometrist, fell apart in about a week. Terrible, terrible. I get diabetic eyes, soft focus. I use glasses and a set of goggles for working on the chassis. You can take that later, Dick. I just brought it up because it sparked something in my mind when you mentioned the microscope to Eric and to Leo.
For a man of your resources, Rich, the jeweler's loop or the headband, the thing that looks like a peach hat that's got two magnifying glasses on the front end, that's a poor man's equivalent to getting magnification. What a jeweler used to do when he's fixing your wife's wedding ring, that's one thing. Modern-day surface mount components on a printed circuit board of modern-day electronics, in my opinion, that is no longer adequate. Once you look through a good stereo zoom, Bosch and Lomb brand or any other brand, well-made brand, there's a whole lot of good Japanese brands of stereo microscope. And don't be fooled. There's a hell of a lot of people that go out and buy a telescope, as an example, and the telescope manufacturer says, goes to 300 power. Bull. The average person who's naive buying a telescope thinks the higher the number, the better. You take the number of inches of the front end of the telescope and multiply it by 60. If the gain of the telescope is beyond that number, you're wasting your time. If you had a 2-inch diameter front end aperture of your telescope, 60 times 2 is 120. As you approach 120, the picture gets fuzzy as all hell. You're going to use that at magnification 30 and 50 most of the time. And the manufacturer may claim you've got an eyepiece in there that'll give you 300. You cannot use it. By the same token, when you buy a stereo zoom microscope, everybody thinks, oh, I want gain of 100. Uh-oh. Most of the time, you're going to sit at gain 18 to 30. That's a lot by comparison to a jeweler's loop. But the fact that you're seeing it in three dimensions, in color, in stereo, with two eyes at the same time, with the right kind of lighting, that's going to give you a feeling for what's going on with that circuit you cannot get any other way. You may have cut your teeth on other kinds of magnification. Once you use the instrument I'm talking about, you will never go back. You will say, why the hell hasn't somebody told me about this earlier? You start doing assembly of circuits, and you start seeing with real resolution what's going on. The little whisker that your eye didn't catch when you did that soldering that's creating a short circuit and making the RF go crazy on that particular circuit. With a good stereo zoom microscope, you'll see it immediately. Let's see, who else had a comment on any of this? K2RIW, listening.
I'll take one more comment.
Okay, Rich first and then Eric in that order. Go ahead, Rich.
Yeah, I'll try and make it brief. Yeah, that's good for like surface mounted work, putting a board down and looking at the chip resistance, chip capacitors, lands on boards for brakes. What I'm talking about, I need something that I can go in and look at a chassis, you know, a hand wired chassis on some of this older gear. And I've got a problem where everything is a sore focus. I wear glasses due to the diabetes, and I think for that a headband would be the best thing, no?
No, this is K2KY. I know exactly what he needs, Dick.
Okay, we're going to go to Eric first and then Mel in that order. Eric, go ahead.
Yeah, you can go to a lot of the electronics sites like Suzuki the place that supplies the colleges, R&R. They have the low power with lights built in, the little headbands that you put on your head that's pretty decent that you can use for that kind of stuff. Although, you know, Dickie's right in terms of the real service mount stuff, because even when you're reworking some stuff and you're using solder paste and sticky flux, when you're reworking something, you reheat it, because don't forget, you're not using a soldering iron, you're blasting hot air at it. The solder tends to bead in between the lands, and sometimes you don't see it, but you wind up with a short, and issues like that, it's hard to see. So, when you're working on that kind of stuff, by the way, most people don't realize that you really need a flea heater so that you don't shock water the components with the hot air. If you do it, preheat the board to 180 degrees, which doesn't melt anything. They get the chips in the right neighborhood, so you're not coiling thermal shock when you actually go work on the component that you want to replace. And the beauty of a VNA, man, is being able to see the admittance. You know, just seeing it, knowing what the reactance is, seeing the Smith chart spit out at you without even having to try and figure it out, and it's a lifesaver when it comes to tuning filters and making stuff like that go. And Howie was right. What the guy with the receiver really wants is, like, working on FM receivers, is a radio test set. You stick your signal on the front and you take the audio out and, you find the point where you've got 12 dB sine add, which is a whole other discussion, but That lets you know what seems to be happening from one end to the other, but it doesn't tell you about NMR, third order mixing products, IMD, that kind of stuff. So. But it helps you fix radios. Back to you, Dick.
Understand. Now, the headband type magnification with or without lighting is certainly more adaptable when it comes to looking over the edge of a great big chassis and you want to check the wiring. Even in that situation, with the right kind of a standoff weighted support mechanism for a stereo zoom microscope, I would even be tempted to still use that, the microscope. I've looked at some very large objects under a microscope where I wanted to look in one little corner to find out what's going on. I guess it was Mel next. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, what Rich wants to work on, this is K2KEY, my chassis work and all. I have a friend that had a similar problem, and what he did, he too, he bought these cheap ones, these Chinese made, you know, they import it, they fall apart, they're pieces of junk. But he found out that there are surgeons, special surgery, that wear these type of magnifying devices that are adjustable with the light on them, that are extremely well made. In fact, they're made to be sterilized even. I don't know what they cost, but a good surgical supply company will definitely have them in stock because it's a commonly used device for surgeons, take over.
You're talking thousands of dollars, and I've looked into them. They're really good, but they're really expensive.
Roughly how expensive are they?
I looked at one set because one of my friends is a surgeon, and he's showing me some of the stuff that he was working on. And they're made by B&L, they're made by Nikon, they're made by a whole bunch of manufacturers, and they're not cheap, you know, 2 grand, 3 grand, that kind of thing. But don't forget, medical industry, sort of like the broadcast industry. You don't make millions of cameras, you make thousands of them. Got to get your money back somehow.
K2YO. K2YO. I think you've signed it before. Please tell us your name, sir, and proceed.
Good evening, gentlemen. This is Bernie, K2YO. Just a quick question. What kind of, Richard, what kind of magnification are you talking about here? Are you looking at 5, 10 power, 100 power? You know, as the conversation seems to have ranged across everywhere from 1 power, I'm just curious. What I was also going to throw in, back when I look at some...
Oh, I'm not sure in power, but to give you an idea, my eyes have gotten worse to the point where I have to use a garden variety magnifying glass to see color bands on a half-watt resistor. When I watch TV on a 26-inch LCD set, I put glasses on. So it's like a... Everything is like, you know, it's fuzzy. It's not, it doesn't come to a good focus anymore. Back to next.
B2HWW, and a comment in the subject area?
I suspect that 5 to 15 magnification would do you most of the time, Rich. Go ahead, Eric. I mean, Howie.
I would tell Richie to do is look in, calling the lighthouse, or call up. I think there's an optometrist in Manhattan at the Empire State Building. I think it's called 2020 Vision, and he might want to go see them and find out what he could use, and they can evaluate his eyes because if he they can help him. It's not they doing it for occupation, but you might ask somebody in the occupational area that could help people who are losing their vision to tell them what kind of equipment he would need, so he can do this equipment, you know, usefully. So that's what I would recommend. You can go on the internet, or you can give me a call, Rick. I'll give you a couple of numbers of resources. There are places out there that could help you with special equipment. You know, what Dick is talking about is great if you have normal vision or close to normal vision, but if you have some eyesight problem, if you do, you might want to speak to someone, and you might be given, you know, stuff to help you. Over to you, Dick.
Some good suggestions. Go ahead, Rich, if you need to fill in all of that. N2EO, K2LIW.
K2KEY, I'll tell them what the name of the company is.
I'll catch you on the repeater. I thank you very much. I'm not losing my vision. It's just, you know, I did see a ophthalmologist some time ago, but he said it was age, you know, 58 plus accelerated to diabetes. I think it was terrible. It's just a little hard to work on the chassis. That's all. Over to you, Dick.
I'll tell him the name, Dick. K2KY.
You got it, Mel.
Okay, they make a non-surgical version. In other words, the one that Eric mentioned, because, like he says, it's got to be used by for in surgery where they can sterilize and all. But they make a non-version of it that's fairly reasonable. The name of the company, I just looked them up because I kept that as a note. I think I'm getting older too, and I'll most likely need something like this. It's called OptiVisor. 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 Binocular type of magnifiers. That's the name of it, Dick. It's a copy of the surgical that the surgeons use, but it's specified for non-surgical use, I guess, basically because it's not sterilizable, over.
Comment, please, HWW.
Go ahead, Howie.
I used it before I lost all my vision. I use a CCTV camera. They have a camera that allows you to magnify and unmagnify it, and therefore a complicated one. They have a lot of equipment available now for people who are losing their vision. So I would call the Lighthouse, or I would call this place in Manhattan. And the reason why I'm suggesting this, Dick, because not because you know, you're not giving him good advice, but they may want to evaluate him. And Richie, just because you're not losing your vision, you don't have perfect vision, and there are ways to make your life a lot easier. Just, you know, at this point, you don't want to give up doing this stuff. And there's a lot of techniques for people with low vision, and I've lived with low vision all my life, so I'm talking from experience. So get somebody to evaluate it professionally, and that way you'll get the right equipment to do the right job. Back to you, Dick.
The company called Maxi News also has stuff with some low vision.
QQQIQ.
Okay, Maxi Aid sounds like a goodie. Glenn, go ahead.
Dick, this is something that I've been working with for about the last 2 years, both of the phones. So working on small surface mounted equipment, one of the things I've been doing now is I got a very, very small laptop or a computer. And the bigger the screen you have, the better. And you can download the InFocus, the tripod right on the circuit that you're working on, and you get an exceptional vision on a monitor that's like right in front of you. That's usually the lighting can be adjusted with the camera. You know, directly looking at the screen, and you have a nice, beautiful, blown-up, sharp image of exactly.
Yeah, but it's not stereo. Okay, go ahead, Bernie.
For free. You may want to call the State New York Commission for the Blind. I don't know if you're legally blind or you're coming close, but if you tell them that you're doing this as an occupation, you can prove that you work out of your house, you may be able to get some of this stuff free and get some professional help. That's just a comment. You can call the New York State Commission for Visually Impaired or State Commission for the Blind, and they deal with everything from people who are just barely losing their eyesight. Over to you, Dick.
Do we still sponsor people for college now?
Oh, we don't know if they still sponsor people in college. Bernie, K2YO, did you want to make a comment?
Yes, sir. I'll just wait till the conversation settles. Just to second what Mel said, I have an OptiVisor. I've had it for probably, I've been very pleased with it. Rich, you don't. You know, I wouldn't worry too much about having to use a magnifier on a cassette with a weighted stand that goes on my workbench now. So a lot of us are getting into that after wear reading glasses and a little extra help. Last comment, Howie, thanks for the suggestion of the folks in the Empire State Building. I don't have a degenerative problem other than just old age, but we're all headed that way, and we're like playing a really small stuff. So it's a very interesting conversation for a lot of us. Thank you, Dallas.
Very fine, Bernie. Glad you're enjoying this. Bernie, you've got a nice, clean signal, good audio, but nowhere near enough of it. Your audio strikes me as being about 8 decibels low of the amplitude it should be. That particular rig could use a lot more deviation. Back to you, Bernie.
Can you make another comment on this subject, because this is very dear to my heart?
Yeah, go ahead, Howie.
Audio as well. I don't know what's going on. All right. Just want to make a comment. Everybody's getting older. I've lost completely all my eyesight, but for many, many years I went through college, and there's a lot of aids out there to help people. And I've worked in the electronic field for years and done stuff. So just because you're not legally blind or coming close to it, you may not be able to get the financial aid, but you can definitely tap into the resources. There are so many techniques that are out there that can make people do the job a lot easier. And don't be ashamed to ask, because you don't realize it. You don't realize that sometimes you can find an easier way to do things because you're losing years. And you know what? Sight can sneak up on you. So that's all I can say, Dick. And I think the place is called 2020 Vision. They're located at the Empire State Building. I think they're on the 6th floor. I've used them over the years. They're not cheap. I mean, I think the vision's like $150, but the guy knows what he's doing. He's an optometrist, and he has all kinds of devices, and they got CCTV cameras, and they got all kinds of equipment, and he can definitely evaluate you and tell you, you know, where you stand. Back to you, Dick.
That's a good thing to know. And some of it for genetic reasons, also because of nutritional reasons or whatever, our vision starts drifting, starts changing. Macular degeneration, among other things, something to keep track of. As we're all discovering, vision is an extremely important thing to have. And with any further questions or comments on all of the above, give me a call at us right now, K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay, it looks like we've answered the questions of the people who signed in. I don't see anyone else. Oh, yeah, Paul. My goodness. WS2N. Paul, I hope we haven't put you to sleep. WS2N, K2RIW.
Guys, stand by one.
We're going to stand by for you.
Okay, Dick. That was my HT. Now I'm on my base rig. Let me shut this other one off. Okay, Dick. I have a question regarding my HF rig, 20 meters on a Kenwood 440. I wonder if you want to take that now.
Now's the time. You got the floor.
Okay, I'm 20 meters, you know, you click over to 20 meters, and it has an internal antenna tuner. So I'll push that button to try to tune up one of my dipoles, the 20 meter dipole. And what happens is the light on the, you know, the digital readout tends to go out, and then sometimes, you know, if you leave the button in long enough trying to tune this thing, the actual light on the F meter will drop off, as well as the you know, any of the LED lights that are lit on the front end of the Kenwood 440. Then you don't hear the internal motors searching to tune up. Now you go over to the other bands, 80 meters or 40 meters. You know, it works fine there. It does have a similar problem on 30 meters, the CW. And it will also tune up on 15, so really 10 meters and 30 meters. It almost like tells the power supply to cut back on the power. I think directly from the power supply itself. I use the Kenwood PS50 power supply for it. I wonder if it rings a bell, a common problem with the rig. Now, I'd say 80% of the time. Once in a while, if I leave it on long enough, sometimes I'll hit that antenna tuner button, and it will tune up there, but sometimes it's right away, sometimes not at all. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I've got a guess as to what's going on here, Paul. Let me ask you first. Can you override or can you force enough power to be fed into the antenna? Let's start off with a 20-meter antenna, such that you're able to measure the standing wave ratio. Have you ever seen forward power, reverse power, compared the two on a standing wave ratio meter of some kind? Bird watt meter plus a calibration, a lookup chart, or a VisWatt meter itself. What do you believe is the real VisWatt on the average day of your 20-meter dipole? Back to you, Paul.
Okay,
see now?
What am I doing here? Okay, I had the, had the box on the HF, and as I'm talking, the, you know, any kind of power drain, if you key up on CW or talk into the microphone, the same thing happens, the lights start to go out. Yeah, I could bypass that. I don't have an external antenna tuner, but even if I did, I wouldn't be able to get enough power, and I don't think, into it. What I do is I'll bypass the internal antenna tuner, and I'll just try transmitting into the antenna. And again, the lights will dim out. You know, the, I'll lose the digital readout, and the 12 volt light behind the S-meter. I know the, I know it's 12 volts because I did change that one time many years ago. I had to get in there and re-solder a little little light behind that, behind the S-meter board. Gives me, you know, that meter gives me a SWR or a power reading or standard S-meter numbers. When everything was working, you know, on 20 meters CW, I had mainly set for, it was probably about 1.1 to 1, and then it goes up from there. But I normally could tune up the whole band, phone and CW, no problem. Thank you, Dick.
Yeah, 1.1 maybe is the standing wave ratio you manage to adjust to on the input side of the automatic antenna tuner. I'm asking you for your best guess as to what is the real standing wave ratio of the barefoot antenna itself. Can you by any means feed 20 meter power into that antenna and measure how much gets reflected? Do you have any guess as to what your standing wave ratio of your 20 meter antenna by itself might be? Back to you, Paul.
Yeah, because, you know, I'll disengage the internal antenna tuner, and I'll set the switch to SWR, you know, this one, everything's working fine, and just key down on CW, and I'll, you know, I'll get this close to 1.1, not 1.1, 1.5 for one, by keying down on CW and CW portion of the band. I've seen that many times. That works fine. Of course, when this is happening, the meter doesn't move. It's like somebody disconnecting the power from the rig. You know, my next step is to bring a battery in. I'll bring a battery and disconnect the whole power supply and see what happens. I'm sitting here the whole night thinking how I could further test this. I'm going to give that a shot. Yeah, that works. Maybe it's
a
big power supply.
WHYY. Joe recognized, but I got a question for you first. What kind of ballon are you using on the 20-meter dipole? Is it a center-fed 20-meter dipole?
Yeah, it's center-fed. Oh, I did away with the one-to-one ballon I had up there years ago. It's one of those PVC, I forget the guy's called. They just sent the wiper and had a crack and wound up with water in it. So I did away with that. I just did away with this whole coil, and I just left the eyes and resided the connection. So it's just a dipole without a balancing.
Okay, a dipole without a balance. There's a 50-50 chance you've got a significant amount of RF crawling down the outside of the cable. When that hits the power supply, it can drive it crazy. Minor changes in the way you dress that cable would make a change. Putting bypass ceramic capacitors on the output leads of the power supply could help ceramic capacitors to ground as RF bypass. RF energy that gets into a voltage-regulated power supply can do some strange things. And what you're describing right now seems to fall into that category. Let's see what Joe's got to say. A2RYY, A2RYW.
Okay, Dick. I have a TS-440. I also have a TS-450 and TS-690, which is they're similar radios, just a couple of years apart. I don't believe there's an antenna tuner to really try to handle. I don't think the cable is handling too much more than about 3-4 to 1 VSWR. And I think you're right on the what's happening. It probably has too much to work with and can't handle it. Another question they ask is. Is the radio and chassis itself grounded to anything substantial?
Well, by way of the coax cable that goes... No. First of all, he claims he's got a 1.5 standing wave ratio on the barefoot antenna. The antenna tuner should not have any trouble with that. However, the antenna tuner can be driven crazy by RF energy on the outside of the coax, and the power supply certainly can. And it sounds like it's an intermittent condition, and RF on the outside of the coax will do that. You just put your hand on the coax, the amount of RF that gets to the power supply change, and the power supply may come out with a different voltage. It would be awful nice to put a voltmeter on your 12-volt power supply to find out what's going on during these tune-up procedures. WSQN, K2LIW.
K2KY.
I'll give you a little bit more information as stand by 1 second.
Yeah, I have another comment reference to the same subject. You might want to try testing the transceiver on all the bands into a dummy load and make sure the microprocessor is capable of adjusting the antenna tuner circuitry properly on all the bands just to make sure it by itself is working correctly. That takes the antenna out of the equation.
That's a goodie. Go ahead, Paul.
This radio is it's an ICOM radio I also have running off the same power supply. And when this happens, I can see that this radio is light is dimming on the ICOM radio as well. So it's like I'm losing power from the main power supply. So my guess, you're right. I mean, if I put a voltage meter on, I'll somehow eventually get to that point. But I'm willing to say I'm losing power. But somebody coming on saying, well, similar problem, you know, it's generic with that transceiver and take it from there. But this is not that, by the way, I don't think it's the internal battery. I've changed that over the years. That was different. Systems that was created when that happened, and it turned out I had to send away the radio to Kenwood. It had to change out a PL board that was improperly made. That's a long story, but they installed a different PL board completely. Their process was based off of loop in the early Kenwood 440s. But I see this as a different problem. By the way, this has been hooked up like this for years, and this is only happening recently. So, and I also changed between the 20-meter dipole and the 80-meter dipole, and I'm getting the same results. I don't hear those motors, those little like the 12-volt motors turning the variable capacitors or inductors inside the rig. I don't hear them turning when this problem is happening. Only. You know, when I go to a good band, then I'll hear the motors turn. In fact, there's an LED light that lights up when it's properly, you know, searching. The light doesn't even come on. You know, it's like somebody's pulling the plug back you there.
Dick, take the KY.
Yeah, Mel recognized. Everything I'm hearing tells me RF getting into a power supply could very well be giving you grief, particularly where you see another rig going dim at the same time, running off the same power supply. I think you're getting RF into a power supply. Why it suddenly happened is a little bit mysterious. Go ahead, Mel.
case. I've heard this problem. This is K2KEY. I've heard it before. I heard it discussed. The motors will lock up under certain conditions. I don't know if it's so much RF coming back, but they have. That was a complaint that's been going on for a number of years with a number of those radios that use the two servo motors to adjust the automatic antenna tuner. The motors lock up. It seems like they search to the end, and for some reason, even if the antenna seems to be resonant, I've heard a couple of people say that they use their handheld analyzer, and the antenna seems to be within reason, yet they will have this problem. And it seems like the motors, like I say, will come to an end and then lock up. And of course, the power supply, if he's got the original power supply that came with that radio, the AC power supply, it is marginal. It doesn't have much leeway, so if you're going to draw a high, all of a sudden a higher current on that line, it will drop it. I think it's part of the protection of the power supply thing, over.
And where he's using that power supply to power two rigs simultaneously, I think he's really pushing it. I would buy another Balun and or make a poor man's Balun memo, as I see it, Paul, just by putting a few turns of coax cable taped together near the dipole is something you definitely should do, because you're showing us two pieces of evidence, a power supply that doesn't have enough current capability, a power supply that maybe is seeing RF effects that are driving its reference voltage crazy. And by putting your volt-ohm-milliampere, you got to be a little bit careful with a digital voltmeter. Sometimes the RF energy of a digital voltmeter will drive it crazy. Just by putting a known good voltmeter, maybe more than one of them, on the 12-volt power supply while you're doing the tune-up procedure will give you a clue as to what's going on. You see that voltage drop down to 9 volts. You know that something kind of crazy is happening. WS2N, KQLIW.
That's not the way to find it. I'll tell him how.
Okay, go ahead, Mel. He's got the answer. Go ahead, Mel.
Hey, a couple of guys, how they did it, they put an external tuner on the antenna. In other words, an outboard tuner. Then they put the radio on without the auto tuner. It worked normal. When they push the auto tuner, now it also works normal. Only when it goes directly into the antenna, Dick, over.
Oh, yeah. By the way, once you confirm your power supply is not aggravating the problem, it's putting out 13.8 volts, come hell or high water. Once you confirm that, and it may take some RF shielding or a balancing device on the dipole to stop the craziness of the power supply. Or maybe you're going to have to disconnect the second rig so that the power supply is only powering one rig at a time. Once you do that, if you still have a problem of the automatic antenna tuner locking up, you're going to have to recognize the fact that if you had a Smith chart in front of you, and you were studying it because you're going back to Mel's special course on Smith chart, which, by the way, you can find by going to the appropriate page of amateurradio.tv. That Smith chart, on that Smith chart, every possible impedance that you can see on the input of a transmission line is somewhere on that chart. The whole world of possible impedances are on that chart. That's the main benefit of a Smith chart. It has. There's no impedance in the world that can't be represented on that chart. However, every real antenna tuner cannot cover the whole chart. It covers some portion of the chart. If your particular antenna falls into one of the forbidden regions or near a forbidden region, it can occasionally drive your automatic antenna tuner crazy. It doesn't know what to do because it's right on the threshold of a bad region. Most of the time, by adding another length of coax cable to your transmission line, what you're doing is you're taking your real impedance, which is a dot somewhere on that Smith chart. When you add extra cable, you are taking that dot and you're rotating it clockwise around the center. You could set your calipers. If by some magic you knew the exact impedance of your antenna and you put a dot on that Smith chart, and then you set your compass with the pivot on the center of the Smith chart and the pencil on your dot, and then you swept a circle, as you add extra length of cable, you are moving your dot along that pencil circle that you just drew. And with the right length of cable you add, you will get your real impedance of your antenna into one of the good regions of the Smith chart where your antenna tuner is happy. It's a very simple thing to do. So there's a step-by-step procedure here. Confirm your power supply, disconnect the second rig, try to put it on balance to make sure the power supply works better, is not seeing RF, and then if your antenna tuner still goes into a lockup mode, add an extra piece of coax cable. I recommend you do that in that order, or something like that order, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW on the deck net.
Okay. Yeah, by the way, I turned off the 2-meter rig, and I've tried that in the past as well. Yeah, not actually disconnected it. I'm good for that stuff, too. But, I've got a harness for the rig. I could bring one of those there. Got a 17 amp hour battery, one of these batteries that you could jump a car with, quarter pack. I'll bring that in, plug that in. I have a setup for that. You can't use the cigarette plug. I actually use the jumper cable. I've got a whole setup for that. Take my jumper cables, I connect it to the harness, plug that into the back, and I'll see what happens. Dick, like you said, I'll stop at the power supply first, and I get a voltage reading out of it. I mean, yeah, if you push that button and it starts transmitting, I mean, should I still see 13.8 volts? Won't that drop down? I guess it shouldn't drop down significantly, but do you think it would stay and remain at 13.8, or should it, Dick? If it's transmitting half a dozen watts or 10 watts, whatever these things that go out on low power, I think it's 15 watts back in there.
If you have a real voltage regulated power supply, and assume now it's got four output screws, and there's a jumper that goes from the sense line to the plus 12. There's another jumper there that goes from the sense line of minus into the minus 12, minus lead. And if you've got that sensor adjusted that way, at that point is where it's doing the regulating. Those extra sense wires or sense screws on a good power supply allow you to do remote sensing if you wanted to, like at the top of the tower, maintaining the voltage at the top of the tower regardless of line drop. But at the point of sensing, a real good voltage-regulated power supply that's set for 13.8 volts under load. If it went below 13.7 volts, a tenth of a volt drop, I'd be suspicious. Something's wrong. A good regulated power supply is going to stay damn close to the set point if it's a voltage-regulated power supply. If it starts over 13.8 and it goes down to 13.7, I wouldn't worry. If it starts over 13.8 and under full load, it goes to 13, I'm on the threshold of alarm saying something ain't right with that power supply. The next thing I want to do is I want to look at it with an oscilloscope to see if it's also putting out ripple. That's what I feel. Let's see what Bell feels on that one. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Well, that power supply that he's talking about is under full load. Will just make it, I know that one, I believe it's the PS50 power supply. They had problems. There was a number of issues with that power supply, and I know a number of the guys that were using the Kenwood radios got rid of that power supply and bought one of the Astron type of replacement that is a little higher in current rating. That power supply supposedly was, I believe, 20 amperes, but from what I understand, it never made it to 20 amperes before it dropped off considerably. You're talking about 8 tenths of a volt drop. That power supply, I think you measure it, you're going to see a volt and a half drop, Dick, easily over.
That ain't good. That much voltage drop, I think, is going to take the circuitry of the automatic antenna tuner and occasionally confuse it. that's not good. So when Paul does his measurements, and by the way, you don't have to go to full power output. If that rig is capable of 100 watts output, you could set it to 80 watts. Hopefully it'll draw a little bit less current, and maybe the power supply will hang in there. That's another thing you can do. You don't have to crank it all the way. To measure vis-wire of your antenna, to measure proper operation of your antenna tuner, my guess is anything more than 10 or 20 watts, all of that should work correctly. So the exact peak power output for what you're doing right now to do troubleshooting, you don't have to have 110 watts of output to do that troubleshooting, in my opinion. So you've got a bunch of tests to do there, and maybe you're going to have to hook up another power supply, Paul. Drag your feet a little bit in case someone else has got some suggestions on this one. WS2N with a little bit of delay, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Yeah, that radio should be able to go down to about 10 watts if you turn the carrying control up all the way and turn the power down. At minimum, it should put on only 10 watts. And it puts out about 10 watts when you energize the UNMAC antenna tuner.
So it does its automatic antenna tuning at 10 watts. And even at that power level, he is seeing the lights go out, which is very mysterious. So he's either had a failure of that power supply, or it's seeing a huge amount of RF and going crazy. There's a bunch of things to be troubleshot here. And maybe one of the things you're going to have to do is put a poor man's balance, three, four, or five turns of coax taped together near the antenna, near the dipole itself. Back to you, Paul.
Okay, very good. Yeah, and Mel's right. That was a 20-amp power supply. And, they send you the schematic with this thing, and there is more stuff inside of this power supply. It's heavy. It's got a big transformer in it. You know, it's not a switching power supply. And I figure this is good for until the end of the world, this thing. But Mel's saying problems. Okay. I'll have to take a look. I'm pointed in that direction. If I'm getting RF back, of course, that's not good. But we'll start with the power supply. I'll hook up a thermal battery. I'll get some voltage readings from that. I know that's going to change. And then if that's good, then I'll see about the power supply. See if I can get the voltage readings off of that. Oh, wait, yeah, that should be no problem. I have the connectors in the back. I'll just